This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about The Good Dinosaur, Creed, Victor Frankenstein, and The Danish Girl. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park. I've got an interview with Pixar artist Bryn Imigeri. I'll also talk about the box office predictions and, of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. Let's just say that The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2 was a bit of a disappointment at the box office. The thing I want to address is the fact that there are people that can't come to terms with the fact that this is not good. Look, I'm not laying the blame at Jennifer Lawrence's feet. Mockingjay Part 2 was not a disappointment because of Jennifer Lawrence or because it's a female-centric franchise. And these two people in particular, they're trying to make excuses for Mockingjay's poor performance because they don't want the female to be at fault. They're so hooked up on the gender politics. And here's the thing, not calling a spade, not calling a disappointment is just as bad for gender politics in movies as it is to blame it on the female. Look, the Mockingjay Part 2 had some problems, and it all goes down to the core that they shouldn't have split it into two movies. But let's not twist the performance of a popular film series just to fit your political mindset. Both this and Divergent, these two box office pundits in particular, have such invested interest in female-centric franchises, and they want to champion women's rights in movies, that they're going to excuse everything. Oh no, Shailene Woodley and Jennifer Lawrence can do no wrong. We're going to defend them on everything. No, it was a bad idea to split this into two movies. Yes, $100 million is a good opening for a film. Any film getting $100 million or more is good. But Hollywood doesn't look at things as $100 million works for everything. When Avengers Age of Ultron came out this summer, it not making $200 million was a little bit of a disappointment. And people are like, well, why didn't it do as well as the first one? That's a valid question to ask. Even though it was like, what, $190 million over its two, if it had only made $100 million on the weekend, it would have been considered a flop. $100 million is great for the opening of a movie, but it's not so great for The Hunger Games. Why? Because out of the gate, the first one made $150-some million its opening weekend in March. That's a huge regression for a movie. You had $150 million-plus opening. Then when they did the second one, $150 million-plus opening, then it was a little bit softer for Mockingjay Part 1. And then Part 2 took a huge nosedive compared to this $150 million opening for the franchise. You're seeing diminishing returns, whereas even franchises like Twilight, there was at least a steady, okay, you were good for about $150 million opening weekend, and you could probably get close to $300 if you were lucky. I think part of it also has to do with the fact that the last book is not about the Hunger Games. And that's not saying that people are bloodthirsty in the audience. The games made a great movie. But Mockingjay 1 and 2 were about a political revolution and politics. So it's a different focus. People wanted the spectacle, but they didn't want to be preached at, which these last two movies got really preachy. The bottom line is there's a significant dip, almost 25% from Hunger Games 2 to Mockingjay 1. And then another 20% from Mockingjay 1 to Mockingjay 2. That's not just a change in the stories. That's because it's splitting the movie. Don't defend it because it made money. It was bad for stories. It was bad for the characters. And it didn't serve the quality of the series. It now has become just a fan service franchise. And that's how they ended it. People forgave Mockingjay 1 to a degree because it made money, though less than the previous ones. But ultimately, by putting that second movie and making it about a political revolution, making it not about the Hunger Games, and preaching at people and padding it out, you lost viewers. There's no question you lost viewers. And if you don't think that this is a 1-2 punch between Mockingjay and The Hobbit, because look, The Hobbit had domestic diminishing returns. It was like a 13% dip between 1 and 2, and then a 30% dip between 2 and 3. People are tired of them splitting up movies. People see through this nonsense. If you don't think it's happening, look at Mockingjay. Now look at Divergent. Divergent, they split the last book into two movies. Now they're trying to obscure the part 1, part 2. And this is Lionsgate doing it. The fact that they're trying to hide that it's a part 1, part 2, because they're going with Allegiant and then Ascendant, that shows that they're adjusting this pattern. And you're really going to get a sense on whether that part one, part two is a poison in the marketplace is if Marvel starts to change the Infinity War titles. That's not the same because it's not splitting a book. It's a story that you can flesh out, but it'll definitely be a nice indicator. But don't go around saying that it was a good decision to split Mockingjay into two, because I think what Lionsgate wanted, they wanted, from a domestic standpoint, money-wise, they wanted four movies that made $400 million, and they got two of them. Then the third one made a little over $300, and this one, I'll be surprised if this thing goes much more over $200. And so what they've ended up with is they've ended up with a little bit more money, but not a ton. It was not the windfall that Twilight and Harry Potter were. Lionsgate came out, their stock dipped, they had some problems on Monday trying to scramble and justify their decision. But the other reason why this is a problem for Lionsgate, and no one's really talking about this, the real reason that it's showing some cracks in the armor at Lionsgate is because of two reasons. First of all, Hunger Games is their last mega franchise. Twilight replaced Harry Potter, Hunger Games replaced Twilight, nothing's replaced the Hunger Games since. So this was the last-ditch effort to have the big franchise. Now they've got to find something new, and they're scrambling or build a series. The other reason is, and a lot of people aren't talking about this at all, earlier this year, Lionsgate announced that they were exploring possibilities of a prequel, sequel, sort of the way the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them was an offshoot of the Harry Potter movies. That's dead. I don't think that's going to get developed. Because people are going to say, oh my gosh, people are tired of the Hunger Games. They're not going to want to throw $150 million into a movie that may not make $75. Now, I'm not saying it's a good idea to expand the Hunger Games universe, but in terms of business decision, they did not go out on top. It's a sour note. It's indicative of them how they can handle a franchise. They did not run the franchise properly. And this is part of the reason why their stock dipped. And this is part of the reason why it was a bad idea from the beginning. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the trailer park. The big trailer that's making a lot of news this week is the Captain America Civil War trailer. It just dropped before Thanksgiving. Opens on May 6th. Let's listen to it.
Captain, while a great many people see you as a hero, there are some who'd prefer the word vigilante.
Stay out of this one, please.
Captain, you seem a little defensive. Well, it's been a long day.
Sorry, Tony.
You know I wouldn't do this if I had any other choice. But he's my friend. So was I.
This actually looks like it's going to be better than Avengers Age of Ultron. And part of the reason for it is it's not trying to service everything in the universe. It's not trying to have every single character in there. It's not trying to set up stories for a dozen other movies. It doesn't have a cast of thousands. It's got some of the people and you got some crossover, which looks really cool, but it's ultimately a smaller story. The Captain America series is actually turning out to be the solid series. This one looks like it's a nice continuation off of Winter Soldier. This looks good. I'm looking forward to it. And this one's going to kick off the summer in 2016. Early in the summer, we're going to get this movie. The Huntsman, Winter War, opens on April 22nd.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is the most powerful of them all? If it's a fairy tale you're hoping for, prepare yourself for so much more. You will train, you will harden, you will become my huntsman.
This, it just looks so heavy, and this is the same problem I had with the first one. It was just so heavy and dark and morose, and yeah, it did well, the first Snow White and the Huntsman, but now they've gotten rid of Snow White. They kicked Kristen Stewart to the curb because she was banging her director, and they don't want that kind of drama on their hands. The fact that Kristen Stewart's not in it is a plus for me because she was terrible in that first one. And I just hope that they give a little more energy to the story, but it still looks like everyone's taking this way too serious. I'm out of time for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Good Dinosaur and Victor Frankenstein. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling into the movie reviews. Let's talk about the new Pixar movie, The Good Dinosaur. In an alternative world where an asteroid didn't wipe out the dinosaurs, one of them is separated from his family and must return with the help of a feral human child.
I think we went far enough today. Let's get you home.
Get home. I'm done being scared.
If you ain't scared, you ain't alive.
It is true. We've gotten two Pixar movies this year. Now, Inside Out was such a fantastic movie and so very Pixar. It was so high concept and so much heart and so sweet and so out there. Like Up. Up was such an out there idea that only Pixar could do this movie. This one's a little more traditional, we'll say. This one actually feels a little more like a Disney movie than a Pixar movie. And that's a fine hair to split. But fans of The Mouse House are going to know what I'm talking about. It's a little bit more of a traditional story of like a homeward bound, incredible journey type thing. We've seen this general story before. Heck, we saw it when Finding Nemo, although Nemo was a different offshoot, and that was Pixar, but it took it from a different angle. This is kind of a boy and his dog trying to get back home. You know, it's been done before, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't work. It's a charming movie. It's a sweet movie. Like anything you're going to see from Pixar, it's beautifully animated, amazingly animated. And like I said, later in the show, I'm going to be talking with Bryn Imigiri, who was the shading art director on this project. And you'll hear a little bit of the background that goes into it, because what's so amazing about this movie is it's all CGI. We've gotten to the point with Pixar movies that you go see them and you would believe that it's just photographs, film photography of the natural world. Disney made the movie Dinosaur, which is similarly themed, not just because it has dinosaurs, but it's sort of this migration movie. And that was made, oh gosh, almost 20 years ago. And that was full CGI dinosaurs, but they shot against real backgrounds. They shot like in Death Valley, and they shot in, and they got all the background plates, and then they animated the dinosaurs into them. They did the same thing with Walking with Dinosaurs, which came out, I think, 2 years ago, right around this time, where they used live action backgrounds and they put the CGI dinosaurs in them. This is all generated. This is all on a computer. Not a single pixel of this movie is a real photograph. Pixar has gotten so good, their stuff is almost indistinguishable from the real thing. Live or Memorex, it's, is it real or is it Pixar? And the characters are very stylized and cartoonish, but they exist in this photorealistic world that's breathtaking. And what's funny is my youngest son, he's 7, he dug out our Toy Story videos and said, I'm going to watch all Toy Story movies this week. And so he was doing a little marathon himself watching all the Toy Story movies. And I went down to the TV room and he had Toy Story on, the first one. And it's kind of amazing to watch that movie and see how rudimentary the animation is and how pixelated the backgrounds are and how low res some of this stuff is, because that stuff was made 20 years ago. But The Good Dinosaur is jaw-dropping, the amount of animation. And the story's good too. It's a very sweet story. It's a standard story. And it hits all these beats that you'd expect from a Disney movie. He's running into people along the way that are helping him out. It's got this very sweet boy and his dog relationship that's flipped because the dinosaur is sort of the boy and the boy is the dog. His name's Spot. Very sweet and charming and cute. And you can take your kids to it. I took my kids to it. The only thing, please, let me just beg you, if you take your kids to this movie, shut up. I have gone to so many kids' movies, and half the time, most of the time, the problem with the people talking in the audience aren't the kids. I can go see a movie, and if I go see like a Pixar movie or a Disney movie, you expect kids to be making noise and kicking your seat. But I was sitting behind this family, and the mom kept talking to the kid. Oh, look at that. Oh, is that cool? Do you like that? Yeah, I like that. No, shut up. It's a movie. Teach your kids how to sit down and watch a movie. And yeah, if they're going to make noise, they're kids. That's fine. But if you're a 40 or 50-year-old woman, don't be talking to your kids during the freaking movie, you stupid cow. I'm so annoyed with people. I get so annoyed because I see so many movies near the end of the year, and I'm dealing with crowds and I'm dealing with people. I mean, give me January where they don't screen anything. And I'm just, you know, I just kind of binge watch a couple movies on the sneak previews and then review them. So yeah, if you go to this movie, don't take this as an opportunity to talk constantly to your kid. Let your kid watch the doggone movie, you stupid morons out there. That's the sad thing, is in a theater that has probably 300 or 400 people in it, there's like 5 or 6 that are real idiots. Teach your kids how to settle. They're the ones who are actually behaving better than you during the film. Anyways, that's all irrelevant to The Good Dinosaur, because the movie itself is sweet and charming regardless of the creeps in the audience. So I'm going to have to say The Good Dinosaur rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Victor Frankenstein. James McAvoy and Daniel Radcliffe star as Victor Frankenstein and Igor in this loose adaptation of the classic Mary Shelley tale.
Igor, you and I shall be at the very heart of a scientific enterprise that will change the world.
We shall create a life out of death.
It's alive.
Do you realize how significant this is?
Oh, I have an inkling.
I'm Detective Inspector Turpin. I'm here to investigate missing body parts.
Are you not afraid to challenge the natural order,
Mr. Frankenstein?
No.
And it's Frankenstein.
I feel like a broken record because the last couple weeks I've said, why are we having movies come out in November that are horror movies that would very much logically fit in October? We had the Funhouse Massacre a couple weeks ago. Yeah, they released it on Friday the 13th, but it took place on Halloween night. Open it before Halloween. You'll get a better audience. I mean, I know it's crowded for horror movies, but gosh, use your brain. You know, and then I talked about The Hollow last week. This one is, it's a Frankenstein movie. It just feels really odd to open this on Thanksgiving. Opening up against The Good Dinosaur. I guess they're maybe going for counter-programming. I mean, I love horror movies. I binge watch horror movies in October. I really get into them. But you know what? Even I, as much of a fan of horror, is sitting here watching this movie going, this would have been a great thing to release like the middle of October. And now with that said, I kind of liked it. Daniel Radcliffe and James McAvoy have a lot of fun with the movie. They get a little cheeky with their characters. They get into it. They're not taking it overly seriously, but they're doing a serious job to do the roles. And I've always been a Frankenstein fan, and I kind of like some of the things that they did with the characters and their interactions and sort of where they come from and what they're doing. The two biggest problems is the release date. It's not a Thanksgiving movie. It's not the kind of movie where you're going to expect to go see and then go pick out a Christmas tree. The other big problem is that the ending isn't as good as the buildup, and that's tough. If the ending's good, it can make the audience forgive a lot of what happens earlier in the film. But if the ending's not very good and it doesn't hold together as well, then you can have some problems. It's not a bad ending, but it certainly starts to fall apart, and it overstays its welcome a bit. So I enjoyed it for what it was. I would have liked to have seen it in October. Still, Victor Frankenstein kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Creed and the Danish Girl.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the film reviews. Let's talk about Creed. Rocky Balboa trains the son of Apollo Creed, a young upstart who is trying to live in his father's shadow.
Your father was a great man to me.
I don't know him. Ain't got nothing to do with me.
Well, I think you could be great too.
I've been fighting my whole life. It's not a choice for me.
You see this guy here staring back at you? That's your toughest opponent.
Who's next?
I believe that's true in the ring, and I think that's true in life.
I have to admit, I don't think I've seen all the Rocky movies. I know that seems like sacrilege. It's like saying you've never seen The Godfather. But, I mean, I've seen the original. I've seen Rocky. I've seen Rocky 2. I remember seeing Rocky 3. I don't think I've actually seen Rocky 4 or 5 in their entirety. I think I've only seen bits and pieces of Rocky 5 when I was in a hotel room once and it just happened to be on TV and I was kind of flipping between a couple things. Rocky 5 kind of came and went and nobody noticed it. I mean, the series really, in terms of its popularity, peaked with 3 and 4. What was funny is, because you have to watch the trajectory of the Rocky movies, the first movie and even the second one, there are much more character studies. Certainly the first one, the first Rocky, isn't about boxing. It's about a fighter. And that's a symbol for him going the distance and for him to get Adrian. But the stories, it's a love story between him and Adrian. It's a story about a guy bettering himself. He just happens to be a boxer. And it has the big epic ending, sure. But really, the first Rocky is a character study. And just the same as in Rocky Balboa, which was the most recent one that came out, what, about 10 years ago. But yeah, Rocky Balboa was a character study as well. It was not a movie about a fight. Rocky 2 kind of became about the fight. And then by the time you got to Rocky 3 and 4, you were dealing with Rocky fighting this next James Bond villain. I mean, in the third one, he was going up against Clubber Lang, which is Mr. T, who was, you know, I mean, it just epitomized the 80s, the eccentric 80s. And then Rocky 4 was, we're fighting the Russians. So the series certainly kind of turned in on itself eventually. And then like I said, I don't even know what happened in 5. I've never seen the whole thing. But this is different because Sylvester Stallone didn't direct it, although his hands are all over it and he's in it. And he definitely had a hand on this series, as he should. It's his series. This is what made him a star. It is similar in tone to the first Rocky in that it is the character study of Adonis Creed. And Sylvester Stallone is not shy about stepping into the spotlight, but it's much more about Don Creed and his character growth. I think it's a worthy update to the franchise. I mean, Rocky Balboa, again, that's like 10 years old. Stallone was pushing his ability to convincingly play a boxer in that movie. I think that this brings it to a new generation. I don't know if that is as smooth of a transition because Rocky is such a 70s and 80s franchise. It worked with Rocky Balboa because he made it much more modern. But the story of Rocky just feels steeped in the 70s. And there are parts of this movie where, you know, they're in Philadelphia and you see the familiar scenes, you see the steps, you see the L train, and you see, you know, the streets of Philadelphia, and they have the music, the appropriate Rocky background music, not the theme, but the background music. So it feels a bit 70s, but then it kind of yanks you back into the modern age. So it feels a bit out of time. But I mean, it works. I was fine. It runs a little long. This thing's like over 2 hours. But I think that they were juggling a lot more, and they had to give him his background, and they had to give him a love story, and they had to do stuff for Rocky and sort of have his involvement. And Rocky's story kind of gets in the way, but it still works. It's going to be a crowd pleaser. And it's an interesting thing, and this is going to be politically incorrect to say, but if you notice in all the Rocky movies, with the exception of, I don't know about 5, but 4 was not this, but the other Rocky movies, the first 3 Rocky movies were Rocky Balboa beating up a black guy in the ring. This actually gives a chance for the black guy to be the star in the ring, which is going to, I think that's going to impact its audience. I think that it's going to be more relatable to, to use the politically correct term of an urban audience. I think that's going to target that audience much more than getting behind the big Italian guy. So I'm going to say Creed kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a very different movie, The Danish Girl. Oscar winner Eddie Redmayne plays Einar Wegner, a man from Copenhagen who attempts to get the first sexual reassignment surgery.
Exactly what happened last night?
There was a moment when I wasn't me. There was a moment when I was just
Lily. But Lily doesn't exist.
Something changed.
He's lost his way. He needs a friend.
Let me help. I think Lily's thoughts. I dream her dreams. She was always there.
The fact is, I believe that I'm a woman.
And I believe it too.
This award season, there is a huge push for movies about gay, lesbian, transgender issues. You had Freeheld. You have, obviously, this one. You have Carol. You have a bunch of movies that are dealing with this subject matter, and it's deliberate on Hollywood's part. This feels very much like a standard character piece, a very standard costume drama. It's directed by Tom Hooper, who did The King's Speech and Les Miserables. It's a beautiful looking movie, and it's got great performances. But on the surface, it's just a very basic biopic. There's nothing scintillating about it. There's nothing that jumps off the screen. Eddie Redmayne does a great job in the role, as does Alicia Vikander, who plays his wife in the movie. But it just seems somewhat standard to me. That's on the surface. But what I found fascinating about this movie was some of the little things that they were doing that's going to go unnoticed to the regular audience. It plays around it's a movie about gender and gender identity. So obviously it's aware of that issue and starts playing around with the gender roles in the movie. If you watch the film and you watch how his wife acts, she's essentially the male role. She's more aggressive. She's more upfront. She's more typically logical. There's a scene in there where Eddie Redmayne's character is dressed as Lily, who's his female persona. Because, of course, he starts dressing as a woman. And then, because this was pioneering the sexual reassignment surgery, which was at the time not very good. It was very experimental and very dangerous to do. And so Lily's sitting there very demure. And Alicia Vikander's character, because she sits down, she manspreads, and she's sort of just sitting there with her elbows on her knees. And she looks like a guy riding the subway. And I'm like, well, that's deliberate. It's they're clearly making Lily the victimized waif in the film. And it plays well into the story, but it's really Gerda's movie, which is the character's wife. I mean, yeah, Lily or Einar, that's the title character. And he's probably going to get nominations for this. But the real meat of the story is the Gerda character. And I think she's going to be overlooked. That's going to be sad because Alicia Vikander does a great job in it. And she comes across differently than the other movies she's been in. She's been a lot this year. Testament of Youth and Ex Machina, both very different films. This one kind of has the same of female themes because that's what Testament of Youth was. It also takes place kind of in the same era-ish in Europe. So it's her movie. And she does a great job leading the cast. But unfortunately, because of the transgender issues are making the focus about Lily, the character of Lily, I think the character of Gerda played by Alicia Vikander, she's going to get lost in the shuffle. I think she's constantly doing the action. And I think that's an interesting take on gender politics and the way movies are written and delivered nowadays. But overall, I mean, just on the surface, The Danish Girl is just, it's a perfectly fine period piece character study with the historical context. But it's more interesting to pick apart and analyze. I'm such a film geek for doing that, and I'm so pretentious, but I found that the most interesting part. So The Danish Girl kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I got to go to a break. When I come back, my Pixar interview, the box office, and the home cinema roundup.
Shake that.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's roll into the final segment. Let's start things off with an interview I did with Bryn Imigeri, the shading art director for The Good Dinosaur. And she's worked on she's been at Pixar for 18 years, and she's worked on everything from Toy Story 2 and A Bug's Life through Ratatouille and The Incredibles, and did a little bit of work on Inside Out. So I had a chance to sit down and talk to her about The Good Dinosaur and some of the things she did from a more technical side, because that's the stuff I find interesting. I find it interesting how they make things look so real. And because the look of the movie is so photorealistic, it actually makes it interesting to talk to her.
I'm relatively familiar with the animation process, but a lot of people aren't. So
yes,
give a little explanation of what they see on screen when that happens.
So a shader art director designs all of the colors and textures for all the characters and sets in a movie. So I see everything. And I think that my job is to make sure that the characters and the environments can look great together.
You supervise shading on everything.
Yeah, so I get to see the sets through, and I also get to see the characters through. And it's great because I can tell when in production there's a point where I can start seeing what it's going to look like in my mind. Mm-hmm. On The Good Dinosaur, because we have such stylized characters in realistic environments, it's a little bit different than Pixar usually. Usually everything goes a little bit more realistic, mm-hmm. Or everything goes more stylized, like on The Incredibles. Mm-hmm. But on this film, it's interesting because it has that contrast.
Does that provide a real challenge? Because of such, for lack of a better term, cartoon-ish. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The dinosaur's very cartoonish. The kid's very cartoonish.
Yes.
Not getting too technical, but how do you reconcile that from having to blend into a photorealistic background?
Well, I think that the decision to do that was on purpose. We really wanted to get the sets to feel really gigantic, epic, and they have to be very convincing. Mm-hmm. And Pete wanted to have the audience feel that the environment is like a character, and that it's a really big challenge for Arlo and Spot for their journey and for Arlo to get back home. Mm-hmm. So the cartoony characters in the realistic environment, I feel like you feel that the sense of danger more when he's a little bit cartoony. It's an interesting look, because I feel like in CG, we haven't really seen that before.
I remember the first time I saw Ratatouille, and I remember seeing the cityscapes of Paris and thinking, well, there you go. We are now into it looking exactly like reality. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first thought we crossed that bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever at a point, because your job is so nuanced, we'll say, mm-hmm. do you ever get to the point where you're like, nope, we're done. We don't have to advance anymore. Are there always on a technical side more stuff that you're trying to accomplish that maybe we don't see?
I think that it depends on story.
Okay.
That's our main design challenge, is to provide the director everything that he needs to get out of the story. I feel like the story drives the technology, so that our job is mainly to satisfy story and the director.
What are some of the things that we're seeing in terms of just sort of advancements in the artistry mm-hmm. of this? That, again, we're talking, I guess, on a level that the average audience just, they see it, but they don't recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they process it. But what are we going to see this time that maybe we haven't seen?
Mm-hmm. Water.
Uh-huh. That's always
the
a
river.
Challenge.
Yeah. Rivers are always really hard. And this one was so related to story. It's mm-hmm. kind of the yellow brick road that Arlo follows to get back home. Okay. It was expensive, and so the effects team had to be very strategic about how we saw them in certain shots. So the art department, sets department, and effects worked really closely to plan out the river shots. Just being able to be involved from the beginning to the end is really... it's really satisfying, because you see it in the design phase yeah. when it's nothing, and then you know seeing it through the process as it goes through modeling, shading, lighting, and animation yeah. for the characters. I love that.
Yeah.
I love to be in production, and I love to be involved in the process. It's really fun.
Now, if you liked that interview and you want to hear more of what Brent had to say, you go to the Fat Guys of the Movie site, which is fatguysofthemovies.com. And you can find the full interview. It's about 20 minutes. But thanks, Bryn, for taking the time to talk to me. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Obviously, I already talked a bit about the box office. We know that Mockingjay Part 2 didn't do as well as it probably should have done. I had actually guessed $115 million. And that actually was lower than what most people were projecting. People were predicting in the 120s. Some people were suggesting it was actually going to do better than Mockingjay Part 1 because it's the finale. It was being sold as a must-not-miss end of the series, and people didn't buy that. If it had actually made less than $100 million, that would have been news for it kind of being a flop. Even though we're talking just a couple million-dollar difference, that $100 million is an important milestone for a blockbuster to make, especially for a series that opens with $150 million normally. It's going to lose steam fast. I think it's going to get pushed to the side quite a bit by stuff like Good Dinosaur and Creed. Because what you got to realize is, last year when Mockingjay Part 1 came out, the second weekend, it was going up against Penguins of Madagascar and Horrible Bosses 2. Neither of which I think anyone was dying to see. People weren't clamoring for those. Those were, hey, let's see if these things work. But now this one's going up against a Pixar movie, The Good Dinosaur, and Creed. Then Creed's going to steal a good chunk of its audience, because it's the grown-up adult drama that people will opt for instead. And yeah, you're going to have a couple weeks in December where it can actually maybe get a little bit of legs. But boy, when Star Wars comes out, it's going to wipe the map with this thing. I mean, look for Mockingjay's number just to crash when Star Wars comes out. So it's not going to have those legs going into January that Mockingjay Part 1 did, because Mockingjay Part 1's biggest competitor when it got into the Christmas season was The Hobbit, and The Hobbit 3 did okay, but even then you're dealing with a split-up movie that was at diminishing returns at the end of its run. The rest of the films, The Night Before was the best performing one, and it made about $10 million, just under. The Secret in Their Eyes came in with about $6.5 million. That was kind of low for a movie like this, especially with bona fide movie stars like Julia Roberts, Nicole Kidman. Chiwetel Ejiofor is not a movie star, but he's a very good actor. This week, I think that The Good Dinosaur, I think, is going to make about $60 million. It's primed. There's the Peanuts movie that came out, but that was a month ago. So the Peanuts movie's had a chance to kind of to make its run. And then the holidays are always great for kids. I mean, you got the whole Thanksgiving week to do it. And it's, I think, a little bit more mainstream and something that's going to reach a wider audience than The Muppets when that came out a couple years ago and was a little bit disappointing. in terms of its weekend numbers. Mockingjay is going to drop. It's going to be lucky to crack $40 million in its second weekend. It may be even closer to $30 million. It may drop like a stone. We'll see. We'll see what kind of legs this has. See if people just waited out the crowds. I don't know if they will. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the world-famous home cinema roundup. A couple movies from this fall. You had American Ultra come out. That's the one with Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart as dope heads who turn out to be CIA agents. No Escape, which is interesting because I got a solicitation from the studio to review the DVD, and the email said, "Oh, for the World Traveler, No Escape." I'm like, you don't want World Travelers watching No Escape, because No Escape is a freaking horror show for the World Traveler. It's the worst thing that could possibly happen. Unless you're telling people to watch No Escape as a cautionary tale, the same way you'd watch Hostel for the World Traveler. But that's out there. Ricky and the Flash, which is terrible, and it is just a giant ego piece for Meryl Streep, and it's boring and terrible and preachy and awful. Blech. No, Ricky and the Flash. The best one out this week, though, is Shaun the Sheep. I'm going to say I liked it even more than Inside Out. I'm going to say it's the best animated film of the year for me. Stop motion, Aardman animation, the same people who did Wallace and Gromit. It's a charming, fun movie with no dialogue whatsoever, which is kind of amazing. If you didn't see it in the theaters, and a lot of people didn't because it's a little bit out there, worth checking out. It's great, it's charming, and it's something that kids can love and adults can love too. And that's it. I need to go for the week and eat some turkey. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Krampus for a scary Christmas. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.